We come to this passage this morning for this reason. We have been looking for some time at the role of a man in leadership in his home and in the church. We, in a sense, are going to conclude this segment of it and pick it up in the new year because we move to focus on the Christmas season in the next few weeks. But I cap it off this whole time with this passage this morning, maybe from a different angle than you would normally look at it. What is interesting with regard to it, by the way, so that you understand, if you're here Sunday evenings, you understand full well what I'm doing, because actually this is where we're coming to Sunday evening, so I am just introducing you this morning to what we're looking at Sunday evening. I'm also teaching a class in Ephesians, actually two sections of it. And I was going over this with the students, so when I got through, one of them said to me, would you do this all in one message, or would you do it in five or six different messages? I said, well, good you asked. I am going to do an overview with you today, in a sense, of this in this passage, starting from Ephesians 5, verse 15, down through Ephesians 6, verse 9. And hopefully help you to see what the Apostle Paul is doing and the emphasis that he is making. And I hope that it's not just a message to the men, but to everybody, but I am definitely directing myself that way because the passage does. In light of that as well, is interesting because the outline you have before you is an outline from a year ago, September. It is an outline of Colossians chapter 3, verses 18 to 41, and purposefully it has not changed. Actually, what you can do is do what I did, and this is something you, as someone said, you do in your time, but this is something I would encourage you to do. Go through the outline at the bottom, which I'm not even going to get to today. And when you see Colossians 3, 18 through 41 and so forth, what you end up doing is going to the book of Ephesians and comparing it and putting the same verse notations in there, because the amazing truth of it is that there's so much alike. The difference is that Ephesians is so much more expansive than Colossians, but you do understand, I trust, that Ephesians and Colossians were written at the same time. It is really not that material to life, but I do believe that Colossians was written just before Ephesians was written. There are reasons for that. Also, as an aside, when it says to Ephesus at the beginning of the book, that NFSO, which is in some manuscripts, is not in all of the manuscripts, which may suggest what I believe is possibly and probably true, that this letter was not just written to Ephesus. In fact, the matter is probably not specifically written to Ephesus as such, and I'll tell you why, for one reason. Paul ministered longer in Ephesus than he did anywhere else at one place. And yet, it's fascinating, he writes to Romans where he had never been, and he has a long list in chapter 15 and so forth. It delineates people that he's addressing, that, and this is a church he's never attended. It is absolutely amazing that you would write a letter to a church that you have been a part of more than any other church, and there's no personal reference in it whatsoever to any circumstance, to any individual, to anything. I do believe that more than likely, and I'm not alone in this, so just so you understand that, that more than likely this was a letter that did go to Ephesus, but probably went to Laodicea as well. So when you read in Colossians epistle that it says, read the letter I sent to Laodicea, it likely is this letter that he is making reference to. But be that as it may, the interesting point is that he wrote these about the same time. There's so much that there's the same, but then there's so much that is unique to each letter, and that's why each must be looked at in its own regard. As we come to this section, there are some things that stand out in our mind. And again, if you would, the first thing that comes out in here that is hard to miss in this entire section is the prominence of the Lordship of Christ. Now, for the sake of your understanding where we were before, go back with me to Colossians just for a moment. I want you to see the truth there. There's no doubt it's you're right. Ephesians, Philippians, Colossians. Go with me to Colossians, if you will. And just see with me, if you will, there the prominence, if you will, of the Lordship of Christ in that small section. Then come back with me to Ephesians to see how this is so true as well here. It is interesting, as you start in Colossians chapter 1 and verse 9, you will notice with me his prayer for these people. He says in verse 9 of chapter 1, "For this reason also, since the day we heard of it, we have not ceased to pray for you and ask that you might be filled up with the knowledge of God's will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, so that," verse 10, "you may walk in a manner worthy of the Lord." You know, it's interesting because the word, there are several words for knowledge here, but one of them has to do with an experiential knowledge of God. And then he puts a preposition on the front which talks about a full experiential knowledge of God. That you might experientially, and if you will, fully understand the will of God, what it is that the Lord would have you do. Now, it's interesting because just quickly in chapter 1, as we start in verse 13 and following, he deals with the Lordship of Christ. He first of all deals with his Lordship over creation in verses 13 through 17. Then he deals with his Lordship, or if you will, over the church in verses 18 and following. And then he concludes, if you will, his Lordship over your life and mine. So much so that when he comes to chapter 2 and verse 6, he says, "As you therefore have received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk in him." In other words, somehow coming to comprehend the Lordship of Christ in your life. Well, it is significant when you come down to chapter 3, 18 and following of Colossians that you cannot miss the emphasis on the Lordship of Christ. Notice, if you will, 3:18, "Wives, be submissive to your husbands, as is fitting in the Lord." Verse 20, "Children, be obedient to your parents in all things, for this is well-pleasing to the Lord." When you go down, if you will, to verse 22, you will notice, "Slaves, in all things obey those who are your masters on earth, not with external service as those who merely please men, but with sincerity of heart, fearing the Lord." Look, if you will, verse 23, "Whatever you do, do you work heartily as for the Lord." Verse 24, "Knowing that from the Lord you will receive this." The last part, "It is the Lord Christ whom you serve." And even the interplay on words, if you will, in verse 1 of chapter 4, "Masters, grant to your slaves justice and fairness, knowing that you too have a master or a lord in heaven." Now, you can't miss the emphasis in Colossians upon the Lordship of Christ. But I bring you back to Ephesians, if you will. Walk with me through something, and let me talk to you about a term, you know, that you'll hear me use, because I think it's an incredible term. I will talk about it. I will use the term because it's a very basic, simple term. But it is so graphic. An author has used a term. He says, "The apostle unpacks." Okay, now, let me think about that for a while. I go on a trip. And especially when I went to Russia and coming back and stopping off in Germany. I did stop there because a little while on the plane. And I always... I buy something for my wife and my children. And when I come home, the first thing I do is I open the suitcase and begin to unpack. Now just, I'll talk to you about that imagery in a while, because it's so important in this passage especially. Let the author unpack it. I'll take you a verse in a while where we look at this verse and we look at the verse in isolation by itself, and I could sit here and say, "What do you think this says?" And we could come up with all kinds of ideas of what we think it says. But when you look at the passage that follows, the author unpacks it for himself. May I say to you a danger, such a basic graphic thought as that? If I follow anything over the years, listening to people deal with verses in the Bible, they try to unpack it themselves. They need to let the author unpack it for himself. Does that make any sense at all? So we're going to look at this because the author is doing this. Watch what the author does. This is not my doing, it's his doing. Start with verse 15. And by the way, I'll start with chapter 4, verse 1 quickly. And if you want more detail, by the way, you come back tonight and the following Sunday nights and we'll see what we can do for you. 4:1. I therefore, you see, the prisoner of the Lord entreat you to walk. See that word, walk, in a manner worthy of the Lord? He picks up that term again in verse 17 of chapter 4. I affirm together that you walk no longer as the Gentiles walk. In chapter 5, verse 2, and walk in love. Chapter 5 and verse 8, walk in light. You see, there's walk, walk, walk through this section. So when he comes to verse 15, therefore he says, be careful how you walk. Now, he's going to open up this for us, okay? He says, let me define this. And we have three negative, positive statements as he unpacks what he has to say here, see? Not as unwise, verse 15, but as wise. Verse 17, not as foolish, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. Verse 18, not in drunkenness, but filled by the Spirit. Now you see what's exciting here. He says, I will define for you what walking carefully means. Let me define it. Let me unpack it for you. See? Walking carefully means you don't walk as fools, but as wise. You don't walk in foolish as a foolish person, but understanding what the will of the Lord is. You don't walk in dissipation, but you walk filled by the Spirit of God. Now, let me just keep the positive sides for a while, since we need to move through here. If, you see, I want to walk as God would have me walk, worthy of my calling, for one, not as the world does, 4:17. In love as Christ does, 5:2. In the light, 5:8. I will then walk in wisdom. I will then walk in an understanding of what the will of the Lord is. I will then walk in a life that is filled by the Spirit of God. That's incredible truth now. So when you come down here, and we're going to come back to that thought in a while, go down with me then to the issue. I understand what the will of the Lord is in chapter 4, 5, verse 17. Now I come down here to what the will of the Lord is. Notice, if you will, in verse 22, wives, be submissive to your husbands as to the Lord. You know what? And if you just hang in, I want to talk about the husbands today, so just understand this. But you see what the wife is doing, it is an act to the Lord. You know, this is an exciting truth, because what you do, it is not primarily for your husband, it's primarily for your Lord. And in the process, you do what you do to your husband because of the recognition of his lordship. Go down with me, if you will, to children. Children, obey your parents in the Lord. See, this is nice. Go down, if you will, to the section on the slaves. Notice verse 7, rendering service as to the Lord. See, when you go to work, it is not the man you're working for, it's the Lord you're working for. Listen to me, how practical truth is. When you go to work tomorrow, understand who you're serving. Trying to make my boss happy? No. Trying to make the Lord happy? Yes. And in the process of trying to make the Lord happy, you will make your boss happy. Or, you know, actually, though, I've watched cases where one of the seminary students doing accounting for an organization, and it was a mom-pa kind of shop, and they wanted him to do the books the way that would be better for them tax-wise, and he says, you know, I can't do that. And he says, but if you can't do that, then you can't work here. He says, that's a good choice I make. I would rather please the Lord than to try to please you in something that dishonors the Lord. So you see, the issue is who we're serving. And if you look in this section, you cannot miss the primary emphasis upon the prominence of the Lordship of Christ. Christ is the Lord of your life. Christ is the Lord of my life. Christ is the Lord over everything you do in your life, whether it be as an employer-employee, whether it be as a parent-child, whether it be as a husband-wife. It is all focused on the Lordship of Christ. We go back to that simple question that Saul asked God, Lord, what would you have me to do? So before we go anywhere else today, we understand the prominence, you see, of the Lordship of Christ. Go with me to the next part of this. We look at this, the prominence of the home. Now, we have focused on this for so long, but I don't want to stop because somehow we need to keep reminding ourselves how prominent the home is. When he's talking about the Lordship of Christ, he takes us immediately to three illustrations. By the way, let me let him unpack this for us, okay? Going back with me to the third negative positive, remember three negative positives in 15 and following, not as unwise but as wise, not as foolish but understand the will of the Lord, not in drunkenness but filled by the Spirit. Now, he says, now he has, listen carefully, and just hang in there with me and bear with me. There are five participles here. Do you know what participles are? ING words in English, right? Participles. Speaking to one another. Singing. Making melody. Thanking God. Being submissive. Now, it's fascinating because you have these five participles. These are, and by the way, they're all present, so they're continuous. Continuously speaking to one another, psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. You know what? I don't have many believers who speak to me that way normally. But anyhow, it would be nice speaking to each other, but we do that in the context of worship here. Singing, making melody in your heart to the Lord. Those are very closely tied together. Always giving thanks in all things. Being submissive. You know, by the way, all of those, four of them are active. The last one is a middle one, which means it's a volitional thing. It is different than all the rest on purpose because he wants us to understand this is something very voluntary. Every time it's used, it's that way. Every time it's used, it's that way. Now, he says, when you look at this verse in verse 21, being submissive to one another, fear of Christ, people sit down there and talk about this verse. What does this mean? Let him unpack it for you, my friend. Don't try to unpack it for yourself. Fact of the matter is, you know that he is unpacking it in verses 22 and following, because if you look in your English Bible, it says, wise, be submissive, or subject. And you see those words, be submissive, they're not even there. You can tell because there are italics there. See? So you say, where does he get it from? He gets it from verse 21. Therefore, you can see very evidently what he's doing is unpacking verse 21 and verses 22 and following. So let verses 22 and following amplify or modify what he has to say in verse 21. Notice what he talks about. Wives and husbands. Parents and children, verses chapter 6, 1 to 4. Slaves and their masters. Now, when you look at this, we can put it off to work, but basically these are household slaves. This is all a household relationship. I mean, a normal home in the Roman world, if you were a free person, you would have slaves in the home. They were a part of your home. And it's interesting because when the church was first established, it was so much the household and the home. And in fact, when he would write, well, if you will, go with me back to Colossians just for a moment. Notice, as we go to that passage, it is interesting because he is talking to them, and he's talking about the church that is there, and there is the greeting to the people who are there. It's interesting, notice if I'm chapter 4 and verse 15, Greet the brethren who are in Laodicea, and also Nympha, and what? The church that is in her house. You know, it's interesting because that's how you had it. The church was in the home. But so when Paul writes the church at Rome, he talks about the household of so-and-so. In fact, we talk about the household of Stephanus in 1 Corinthians. And he talks about all these households, and the household included husband, wife, children, slaves. They were all a part of a household unit. And then it is not like we have had in this country, but it was. There was that unit. And so what he's talking about is various home relationships. Significant because as you look at these, you understand the focal point of the home. Everything emanated out of the home. Everything emanated out of the home. Everything emanated out of the home. I love it when I hear people analyzing Proverbs 31 where the wife does this and that, and she does. She's very busy. And they try to bring it to modern day America. But you understand, if you grew up in a culture like that, and I did, we had market day every fifth day. There were no supermarkets in town. There were no stores in town. You went to the market, and every fifth day you bought what you would get. And seated around in the market, there were men, but basically it was women out selling the things. And you would raise chickens or eggs or make cloth or whatever in the world you would do, and you would go to the market and you would, you know, in a sense, trade this for that. And so it was the women who did this, and it talks about how the woman would go out and find the land and so forth like that. And women would do that, but so much of what they did out of the context of the home, say. So much was built around the home. I remind you that we see some movement back that way today, and I think it's a very encouraging thing. It's not even whether you believe in homeschooling or not, but I'll tell you what it's done. It's taken the focus back again to the home and said to parents, and parents saying to children, this is our responsibility. I am the educator of my child. I am the one who will train my child in a godly way. We have sent our children to the schools. We've sent our children to the churches. And we've said to the teachers at school, teach our children. To the people at church, raise my children in the fear of God. Without recognizing our ultimate responsibility. And when the children don't learn, we blame the teachers. I'm not even going to say that the teachers are doing the greatest job in the world. That's not even the point. But if you let your child be raised that way, my friend, you understand you are the one ultimate responsible for what happens to your child. The focus is on the home. And I remind you again, when I heard the question in the debates they had, and some lady asks the president-elect, if you will, what are you going to do when parents are not? Since when does the government come in to deal with running the home? I know there are people who want them to do it, but my friend, you don't want them to do it. Not just because it is not a good thing politically, it is not a good thing biblically. But now notice something else, and this is where we would like to draw your attention for a while this morning. Notice, if you will, there is something else that stands out in here. Not only the lordship of Christ, the prominence of that. Not only the prominence of the home, but notice, if you will, something else that's so focal to this passage. And that's the prominence of the husband within the home. There, if you look at these three illustrations, the wife and the husband, the parent and the child, the slave and the master, there is only one constant aside from the lordship of Christ in this context, and that is the prominence of the role of the husband. Now, it is interesting, is it not, that you see he is the husband of the wife. He is the father of the child. In fact, so much so that you notice what happens here when he says in chapter 6, verse 2, honor your father and your mother. Notice that he comes down to verse 4 and he just says, and fathers, fathers. Why not fathers and mothers, see? Why fathers? Does it in Colossians. Why fathers? I'm going to come back to this. So you understand, you see the constant. He is the husband of the wife. He's the father of the children. And specifically drawn out here as separated from his wife, but not separated from her. And he is also the master of the slaves in 5-9. So you see, when he addresses the husband, he is addressing this man. When he addresses the father in verse 4 of chapter 6, he's addressing the same man. When he addresses the master in verse 9, he's addressing the same man. Here he's addressed three different categories, but every time he comes back to zero in on this man. You're the husband. You are the father. You are the master. You can't miss the emphasis of this. Do you know what else is significant? Very significant. Because as he unfolds the truths of this passage, and there's no doubt that the overriding idea is the submission of verse 21, which is an outgrowth of being filled by the Spirit in verse 18. There, it is the fifth thing that flows out of the fullness by the Spirit. It is interesting as you look at verse 21 that it unfolds what follows, and therefore everything that follows is under this heading, being submissive. In whatever role submission should exist, be submissive in that role. Whether it be a wife to her husband, a parent to a child to a parent, parent to a child, sounds American, doesn't it? Child to a parent or a slave to a master. The issue is, the overriding theme is submission. But in dealing with the husband-wife relationship, do you know what? 40 words to the wife, 115 words to the husband. What does that tell you? Almost three times as many words to the husband as there is ever a word to the wife. Try that one on for size before you start camping in this passage, you see, for whatever purpose you would. Somehow, you see, in this passage, there is such a focal point on what he's doing here. Not only is it the man that is involved here as husband, as father, as master, but it is to him that he directs his attention with 115 words to the man in the section of the husband-wife relationship, while only 40 of them to the woman. That should sober us up very quickly. But by the way, as an aside to this, let me draw something else. Now, again, I can only touch on the overriding theme of this passage with you today, and you'd have to come back in the weeks of five. I'm not trying to get you to come back, but that's a fact. You have to come back in the evenings and follow the rest. But let me draw something else to your attention. For those who are here who would say, all right, now hold it. Look at what the wife is told to do. For the wife, verse 22, wife, be submissive to your own husbands as the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ also is the head of the church, he himself being the Savior of the body. But as the church is subject to Christ, so also the wives ought to be to their own husbands in everything. And I just wait for a while, man. Got to talk to you for a bit. In everything. There is no area outside of which the headship and the leadership of the husband is not to be evident. But just for a while. What's significant too, as before I even make this point any further. Do you understand something? Never does he say to the husband, you rule your wife. Never does he say to the husband, you be the head of your wife. He says to the wife, submit to his headship, but never says to the husband, you be the head of your wife. I'm not saying because you're not. I'm just saying that's not the emphasis he makes. The focus moves away from that. But let me talk about in everything. For some husbands, the feeling is that there's a grid here. And I put everything through this grid of submission to me. And therefore, that is the grid under through which everything must pass. Oh, may I remind you that this is a section, they call it these days, whatever that means, they call it a paranesis, this whole section here, which is one command. It's a command. So he starts out in chapter 4, verses 1. He says, I command you. He says, maintain the unity. That's a command. He says a command in 4:17, stop being like the Gentiles. He has a command in verse 25. He's telling them, he says, stop this lying to one another. He then goes on to say, stop stealing. He then says, stop using all this, having all this bitterness and anger and malice, all of this stuff. He says, stop having that. He says, don't ever even be involved with any kind of immorality, not only not to do it, but not even to speak of it. Now just wait a minute, friends. Understand that although there is leadership in everything you see, the wife in submitting to your leadership cannot violate his leadership. She cannot forsake all of these other commands just to fulfill this command. She must not lie for you. She must not cheat for you. She must not steal for you. She must not become bitter because of you. She must not act like the world acts because of you. You see, you cannot cause her to violate that which God has demanded of her, because this is only one of the things God demands, and it must be in association with all of those other things and can never negate any of those other things. And a wife must say to a husband what Peter said to them. I must what? Obey what? I must obey God rather than man. And my friend, the day that you as a man, because of your leadership in the home, demand of a wife that she does that which is contrary to that which her Lord demands of her, you see, she must obey him before she obeys you, because that's part of her obedience to him. Does that make sense at all? You see, submission is not the grid through which you pass every other command of God. Now, something else in here, just for the sake of those of us as men, as we process this and find ourselves being dealt with more and more. As you look at this section in verses 22 and to 33, you can't miss another truth either. It is this incredible truth that the focus of this passage, by the way, is not just saying, you know, Christ and the church is a nice picture of the marriage, see? And that's more than that, my friend. It's more than that. Go with me through the passage. Don't miss the truth. Walk with me. Look at this statement in verse 23. For the husband is the head of the wife as what? Christ is also head of the church. Look at this. Christ and the church, verse 23. Notice the statement in verse 24. But as the church is subject to Christ. Here you have Christ and the church again. Verse 25. Husbands love your wife just as Christ loved the church. Here's Christ and the church again. Go down with me further if you will. Well, actually, that goes all the way from 25 to 27. Come down with me, if you will, to verse 29. Notice, for no one ever hates his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ also the church. Look at the verse 32, and I'm speaking with reference to Christ and the church. Did you understand? What is the focus of this passage? If you keep reading over and over again, which keeps coming back and back and back, is what? The focus on what? What? Christ and his church. Christ and his church. May I suggest to you that the relationship between Christ and his church has momentous consequences for Christian husbands and wives in their relationship with each other. In fact, let me read this to you. The Christ-Church parallel is not simply an illustration for marriage. Now, you will not fully put this up, but let me just give it to you anyhow. The Christ-Church parallel is the generating theological center of Paul's entire presentation. Someone says, I don't like messages on theology. My friend, theology is the basis of it all, you see, the understanding of God. In fact, the question that comes when he talks down later in this passage, and he says this to them, he says in verse 32, this mystery is great. What mystery is great? The mystery of Christ in the church, or I would maybe suggest a fuller expansion of that, the mystery of Christ in his church as a typology, if you will, to the husband and the wife in marriage. So much of the focal point of all of this is, you know, if you're going to understand the relationship that you have in marriage, you start by understanding the relationship that Christ has to his church. You've got to believe in this passage that that is the focal point. It's not about the husband and wife. It's so much about Christ and the church. Because if you understand Christ and the church, you will understand the husband and the wife. It is that theological truth which is the center for everything he has to present in this passage. So therefore you see, But you understand something. This profound theological truth has great practical application. And husbands and wives need to grasp the clear implications of this relationship. Now, with regard to this, I just then want to take you further than this. To suggest to you as you look at this passage, it is fascinating to see what the husband's relationship is to his wife as we talk about this, because if the focus certainly is upon that individual who keeps coming back over and over again, and if the relationship is to be one built on the relationship of Christ to his church. You understand? I reflect this. I was last night just talking with my wife. You understand, the beautiful thing of this is for us to reflect in the relationship, as he says it here, not trying to dream of something, but I am a part of the body of Christ, and she also is a part of the body of Christ. See, we are united in that relationship with him, and he is the head of this body. See, that's why he is the one who makes all of these things, and we are united equally together in this body. I am not, as people would say, I'm not more equal than she is when it comes to relationship to Christ. No, that's not true at all. That's a beautiful thing. Then, the fact that Christ has a body. Now just think of this. Christ has a body which he loves. You think he loves his body? Well, look at this. Look at what he tells the husband. Look at the, if you will, as sort of a bookend, if you will. Look at the statement that we start in verse 24. So also wives ought to submit their husbands to everything. But husbands, verse 25, love your wives. Verse 28, so husbands ought to love their wives. Now you notice what's in the middle? Love your wives here, love your wives here, and everything in the middle is the example of Christ in his relationship to the church. Just some thoughts for you to meditate on. You see, it talks about loving your own body. But look at the illustration. He brings in Genesis 2:24. I mean, it's right here. Look at this. He says, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one what? Flesh. So you see, when he makes this statement up earlier in this passage, if in fact the whole picture is Christ in the church, so husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. No, hold it. Not this, I love my body, therefore I love my wife. No, you understand, she and I are one. If I love my body, she is a part of that, you see. It is not, I love my body, therefore I love her. We are one what? Flesh. Do I understand this? I don't understand it, but I understand it because he said it, and that's how it is. And you see, when I love myself, I love her because we are one. So many of us in this independent age, we want to separate ourselves. She is one, I'm another kind of stuff. There is that independence that God allows it is true, and God allows me to is true. But you understand that when I love myself, she is a part of myself. I am a part of herself. Amazing, he says, the mystery is that concept of the understanding of Christ and his body, Christ and his church, and me, and that which God has caused to be in the marriage that he's given to us. Therefore, he says, you see, notice this, notice if you will. go down to the words that use it just in English. I could give it to you in Greek and you'd even see it more fully there. But go down to this passage. Verse 25. Husbands, love your wives just as Christ also loved the church. And notice, and gave, literally gave over himself up for her. And he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, that he might present to himself the church in all her glory. You know, the emphasis through here is that use of the intensive pronoun, reflexive pronoun, in the sense of the fact that he himself did it. Nobody made him go to the cross. He himself went there for me. Do you understand the beautiful truth of this? You see, the focus, man, is back to us and says, you know what? He voluntarily gave himself for his body. I need to voluntarily give myself. So much in here. The prominence. Prominence of the Lordship of Christ. The prominence of the home. The prominence of my role as a husband within that home. Self-sacrificially giving myself. Just quickly, I would just suggest to you the prominence of the relationship between husband and wife. And I say to all of you husbands here today, understand, took me too many years to figure this out. Not that I have demeaned the relationship to my wife, that's not it, but it took me too long to realize that the primary relationship in our home is not my relationship to my children, it's my relationship to my wife. So many homes, the concentration is on the children. All of a sudden, the children are gone. The highest divorce rate after the early years is after the children are gone. Now you're forced to live with each other again. You see, the prominence of the relationship is the husband-wife relationship, not the parent-child relationship. That is a secondary one. And I go back to it again, that is, come to realize that the greatest gift I can give to my children is to evidence before them the fact that I'm deeply in love with God and madly in love with their mother. I don't think even anything else goes beyond that. Once those two things are evident, you see so much grows out of that in the relationship with them. Why all of these others are secondary? Because they are secondary. The primary relationship is husband to wife. And then just one other thing. I make this statement, the promise of personal renewal over social renewal. You know the trouble with this so often is that when we come to marriage, we get this business today of I have my rights. That's what all this court stuff is over anyhow. I have my rights. I have my rights. I can fight for it. I'll take it. No, listen to me. Nothing here about rights. Nothing here about rights. Nothing. The emphasis is not on one's rights, it's on one's responsibilities, if you will, whether it be the wife or the husband, whether it be the children or the parents, whether it be the slave or the masters. It's not on rights. It never is on rights. It's on responsibilities. Never, never on the context of social reform. I read to you, when the choice comes between reformation and transformation, the choice was clear. In the choice between revolution and transformation from within, Christianity chooses the second always. You see, this isn't something which you legislate something from without and we have some social change. This is something where God transforms our lives and makes us this way. I can only be this kind of a husband if, in fact, there's a transformation of my heart from within. I can only be this kind of father if there's a transformation of my heart from within. I can only be this kind of a master or servant if there's a transformation of my heart from within. And you see, for many of you, as you raise your children, understand what you're praying for is not that they will subscribe. Notice just quickly, because I do have to conclude. Notice this, if you will. Notice the statement. Verse 4, fathers, do not provoke your children to anger, but bring them up in the discipline and instruction, what? Of the Lord. The goal is not how much they subscribe to what you think so much as the goal is to how much they subscribe to what he thinks and demands of their lives. It is an incredible task we face. And what you want God to do is change their hearts so that they will serve the Lord as they ought to do. And in every relationship, it is that. And I would say to you, if you're husband or wife and you're frustrated, listen, believe in the power of God to change the heart. Don't try to change the outside. Pray to God to change the inside. But concentrate on your relationship as God will never do. Bow with me in prayer. Again, our Father, we're so grateful to you. I think of my own life before you right now as I look at this passage and understand the prominence of your lordship in my life. And Lord, I would cry out to you, what would you have me to do? I do want to, according to verse 17, understand what the will of the Lord is for me. I want to be filled by the Spirit because I understand that is a part of it. I want to do these things. I want to speak and sing and make melody and give thanks and function in the right area of submission that you've called me to in whatever order of submission that I must place myself. I pray for the leadership you've given to me within the context of the family and the home. I pray that it will be much as Christ did, that it will be as love as Christ loves, that that will be a part of my life and every fiber of my being, not only to my wife, but to my children and to those whom I work with. Thank you, our Father, for your grace. Thank you for the strength you give. Thank you for the renewal by your Spirit to accomplish these things in our life for your glory. And we praise you in Christ's name. Amen.